Welcome stakeholders who are here from Parliament, this is the second leg of our meeting, namely that to text me. They were an update on progress on the combination relating to Nugget Commission of Inquiry report. As you know, that the President had appointed a Commission of Inquiry led by Justice Minchin. The Commission has since issued the report to the President and made recommendations in that regard. So you are welcome, and also welcome to the media present here. Apologies.
Apologies from Mr. Vesel. Beginning from class, and then Bill Lewis from the PM.
Those are the apologies we got. Any other apologies? Oh, okay. Those are the apologies. Consideration and adoption of the minutes of the 9th of July 2019. Page 1. Any correction? Page 2, any correction? Page 3.
May we rise to observe a moment of silence? Serves as corrective actions to be taken, and they included both those of a policy nature on how to improve governance and to develop mechanisms to prevent, detect, halt, or preclude such failures in the future, aside from dealing with the failings as well. So, Chair, just to give you a background, because I think it's quite important to just verify that SARS enjoys, under the SARS is governed by the SARS Act. The other act that governs how it does its work is done in terms of the Tax Administration Act. And then obviously SARS also has to implement all the various tax acts. How many of them are there now? Really? There's lots. Okay, I think you gave the number the last time, the number of the bottom. At least a dozen, I remember. Okay. And the tax legislation, and then the general legislation like the CFMA, FAJA, that also apply. Now, when you look at the SARS Act, it incorporates, doesn't deal with it explicitly, but underlying it is a recommendation that came from the Katz Commission's report in 1994, which established SARS. There's a high degree of autonomy that's given to SARS, and the Commissioner is responsible. And literally, the Commissioner is king or queen once you become Commissioner. You're responsible for all internal organization, including the organizational structure, the appointment of staff, the remuneration structure, and so on. And this is an important point. The minister does not have the power, or anybody else has the power, to interfere in the powers of the commissioner. As you know, SARS is not part of the public service, but it's part of the public administration. SARS reports to the Minister of Finance as the executive authority, as in terms of the CFMA. So the power that the minister has is to approve the terms and conditions of employment of senior managers. That's the one explicit power that the minister has in terms of the SARS Act. There are other powers in terms of the CFMA, like to approve their cooperative plan and so on. And the Minister of Finance, just to make an obvious point, is not allowed access to any taxpayer affairs. It's illegal for the minister, or in fact anyone else outside SARS, unless there's specific, the commissioner can come in, whether it's a court or whatever, but you are not allowed to access the affairs of any taxpayer. And neither can the minister or treasury or anybody take over any of the functions of the commission. So the concept of autonomy is quite central to any tax collection agency. Then you have the Tax Administration Act, which governs the tax administration processes, how the concepts of taxpayer confidentiality is given effect there. And within that act is the Office of the Tax Ombuds also set up. And then, of course, as I said, there's tax legislation and general legislation. Move on to the next slide. So, Chair, coming back to the Commission, the summary, just to provide a brief summary, the final report then contained 27 specific recommendations. And they've got, in this presentation, we use their references, they've bracketed, which you can then link to the report if you have the full report in front of you. The final report confirmed instances of maladministration and mismanagement at SARS between 2014 and 2017. Each of these occurrences, I think, deserve exhaustive investigation. And some include criminal investigations that are required, and the final report recommends that these be followed by the relevant authorities. The premeditated restructuring of SARS, there's a conclusion that central to what happened was there was a reorganization or restructuring of SARS that took place. And the Commission found that this was a premeditated restructuring of SARS, which was intended to take control of SARS and ultimately bound to cause disruption and bewilderment. As a result, enforcement was deliberately weakened, as the UNICEF investigated the illicit trade ceased to exist. Revenue collection suffered, and that's corroborated by falling taxpayer compliance as well. Also, evidence of abuse of procurement processes, particularly large-scale consulting contracts to reform or restructure SARS operations and information technology systems. The recommendations aim to correct these past infections and to prevent any future recurrence of SARS in the plan. The structure of the report itself, there are 20 chapters. I've just presented this. As I said, the report and all its annexes are available on the presidency website. Chair, now the most urgent recommendation, as I said, was on the appointment of the commissioner, and this was implemented by the president. As you are aware, that's why we have a new commissioner. And the final report not only recommended the removal of the former commissioner, but it also outlined a process, which you can see in paragraph 16.3, namely the appointment of persons. It recommended that there be a selection panel, and that the selection panel be made up of persons should be apolitical and not answerable to any constituency, and should be persons of high standing who are able to inspire confidence across the taxpaying spectrum. The criteria for this appointment is outlined in the report. In terms of Section 6 of the SARS Act as amended, the President has to appoint a person as the Commissioner of SARS when there is a vacancy. So what the President did was, though he wasn't bound by law, because the law says very little, it just gives the President the power to appoint a Commissioner, the President opted to follow the process outlined, because though it's not in the law, it's just an additional, it didn't need the law for the President to receive some recommendations through a transparent process. So the President followed the recommendations on appointment to the letter, and I would say to the spirit, even though this went far beyond the minimum requirements of the law. And I should add, it was the most transparent appointment process to appoint the Commissioner of SARS since its establishment. If you go back to previous appointments, the presidents in those instances exercised their powers. In some instances they were advertised, in some instances they may not have been out. I'm not sure of the history, but there's no doubt this was the most transparent process. The president delegated to the Minister of Finance the process to appoint the commissioner, so the Minister of Finance then appointed the panel. And all the reports on the process were made public on announcement of the appointment of the new commissioner. And certainly the experience that we gained from this process will be incorporated into future legislative amendments that we want to proceed with. So Chair, it's just a picture of all the, you know, on the date that the commissioner was appointed, the announcement was made in early April, there was a media release, there was a CV of the commissioner, the new commissioner, there was a full report on the entire panel's process and recommendation. All of those reports are available, Chair. I did not make copies, but they can be found on the National Treasury website. And if members want a copy, I can provide them to the Secretary. Chair, just to move on. Beyond that then, we've divided the recommendations. I think the most important dealt with the governance of SARS, and they outlined in Chapter 20. The Commission made several proposals related to governance and strengthening of organizational leadership, which requires that we amend the SARS and other acts, which we will be doing. Will be providing a bill early next year. The key principle that the Commission confirmed is the autonomy of SARS. In fact, to use its word, it says it is a non-negotiable proposition that SARS autonomy is sacrosanct. This truism was identified as such by the CATS Commission in its first interim report in November 1994. So I'm quoting from the report. The Commission was of the, to quote them, fervent view that no provisions related to the governance of SAR should have the impact of infringing on the autonomy of SAR. Governance of SAR can be, so that was the first major point that was made. The other major point made was that the governance of SAR can be enhanced by granting more explicit powers to the Minister of Finance. The current act is vague on it, as I outlined at the start. It talked about looking at the terms and conditions of senior management. So paragraph 39 on page 186 of the report notes that since the national budget and tax policy and management of the country's finance rests with the Minister of Finance, it noted that the participation, the participation by the Minister of Finance in certain aspects of the governance of SARS is a reality that should not be viewed as a distraction from the autonomy of SARS. It recommends amending the SARS Act to give additional powers to the Minister, example, in approving the business plan of SARS. The Commission's view is that the Commissioner of SARS should be appointed by the President. So this is an interesting thing. Though they will report to the Minister of Finance, the Commission still feels that the Commissioner of SARS should be appointed by the President after consulting with the Minister of Finance according to a transparent process. So, Chair, it also then recommended, in addition, and to quote it again, it was their strong view that governance at SARS will be enhanced by the appointment of an Inspector General, which is outlined on pages 189 and 190. The Commission believes that the setting up the Inspector General office provides a mechanism to provide oversight over SARS functioning in order to detect abuse in a manner that protects SARS privacy mandate and taxpayer confidentiality. The Commission also recommends legislative provisions, and I'll come back to the role of the board in a second, because many have asked, should there not be a board, what does the Inspector General do? And the Commission dealt with that in detail. But it also recommended a legislative provision for mandatory advisory executive committee, including deputy commissioners. And it said that these should be outlined in the law. Currently, what the law is, once the commissioner is in, the commissioner can decide. So previously, when they were deputy commissioners, that was up to the commissioner to decide. These are deputy commissioners, this is my executive committee. The Commission feels that this should be legislated into the law. The Commission is not in favour of an oversight board. The Commission, to quote, the Commission is not persuaded that an oversight board is indeed a useful instrument. And members can read on page 183 its arguments. I should point out that their view differs with, for example, the David Sex Committee, which in their own report previously recommended an oversight board. The Commission also affirmed the important role played by the Office of the Tax Ombud in paragraph 16.2, whose mandate is to, quote, confine broadly to addressing taxpayer rights, which is its appropriate role. And here's an important point. It feels it should not be involved in the governance of SARS. It should be involved with affairs of taxpayers who feel that there are some grievance with SARS over their tax assessment. So it feels that the tax ombud cannot play the Inspector General role. I should add that the David Tax Committee also recommended a concept of taxpayer bill of rights in this respect. I'll come back to the Cabinet's response to the government, but the other findings that you had were then related to procurement matters, chapters 3, 5, and 11, organizational and design. As I said, they had views on the executive committee, on deputy commissioners. There's a range of matters dealt with on operational matters. They deal with the reputational damage of SARS, and I've already outlined the governance issues in chapter 20. The consistent theme running from the report is that the principal feature of the new structure Now, this is the new structure under the former commissioner. It was to fragment many of the functions that previously had operated cohesively. For example, the large business center was broken up. Any proposals on the structure of such functions must avoid fragmentation. Many of the recommendations relating to governance, accountability, and integrity, as you pointed out, does require amendments to the SARS Act, and this committee will be seized with a matter of considering such bill, and the Minister of Finance will oversee, after giving the approval of Cabinet, intends to table it early next year. This is just for your information of what the TEPS Commission, which was the first commission really established by the new democratic government in 1994. In fact, it was appointed almost within a month or two of President Mandela becoming president. And the first task was to work on the TEPS collection agency. Before that, they were mere departments within the Treasury, and they were separate departments. We had one for Inland Revenue, which is your Inland Taxes, and one for Customs and Excise. And they had asked that these be integrated. Okay. You'll see that this has also been an issue that's come up with the Border Management Authority Bill, which attempted to split the customs function again. Move on. So, Chair, come to government's response after merger. There was, you know, we've divided them into three acts. Firstly, there was the immediate implementation of the urgent recommendations, as I've outlined with the presidency, that was related to the removal of the former commissioner and the appointment of the new commissioner. Then there's a lot on the operational issues, the systematic review and implementation of corrective action. Some have been completed, some underway, and the commissioner will outline those because they fall squarely and mainly in his domain. And as I said, the issue of the governance and so on, we intend to table a discussion paper and draft legislation. So, Cabinet actually discussed this, the Commission's report at its meeting of the 27th of March 2019. And I've just brought you extracts of the press statement that was issued on the 28th. On the same day, it had actually approved the appointment by the President, or supported the President's appointment of Mr. Tishbetter as the new Commissioner. But it also responded to the Nugent Commission. It noted that most failings at SARS stem from a massive failure of governance and integrity. It noted the 27 recommendations. I won't repeat them. It Cabinet expressed its broad support for all the recommendations of the Commission. It did recognize that there was a debate between the Board versus Inspector General, and it requested that the Minister of Finance oversee the implementation of all the recommendations, including, this recommendation is now post the Commission has been appointed, so all the other recommendations. Even if it means that the Commissioner has to implement it, that the Minister is going to check that the Commissioner has implemented or considered all those recommendations that the Commission made. And it asked the Minister to come up with a discussion paper I've spoken about and to lead a consultative and transparent process of public comments before we finalize the SARS amendment bill. It also expressed its gratitude to Judge Nugent. I must say, I think we were very impressed with how efficiently the Commission worked. I will ask the Department of Justice, Chair, with your permission, to give you a full report on what it cost. I guess it was probably one of the cheapest commissions. It worked on time. Really did very well. Formally, after taking that decision, this is what Cabinet has also instructed Treasury to do, or the Minister of Finance to do. Firstly, Cabinet endorsed the importance of strengthening the autonomy and governance of SARS. So in writing the discussion paper, that's like a principle that Cabinet has accepted. The discussion people will deal with all the oversight mechanisms. It will go into the arguments of the board, it will go into the role of the tax ombuds and clarify its role and powers. I know that Judge Mugabe has been raising the issue. And so we hope that this paper will deal with all these issues and assist members and the public to understand what each structure will play. And the minister will then take public comments and lead a consultative process to finalize the recommendations made in the discussion paper, and that will form the basis for drafting of the SARS amendment bill. And in line with the autonomy of SARS, Cabinet left the organizational recommendations to the Commission. I think, Chair, this is just more body detail. So these are all the areas that we think that the Commission has outlined, that the SARS Amendment Act deals with the appointment procedure for the Commission of SARS, including, by the way, the process for the removal of the Commission of SARS. Also, it will deal with the appointment, well, the establishment, appointment, and removal of deputy commissioners. It will expand on the scope of the minister's powers. It will also look at other approvals that the minister will do in line with the PFMA and other sort of governance recommendations. There will also be amendments to the Tax Admin Act that may be required to clarify the distinction between verification and audit, because the Commission went into some of the abuses. If at the time, Chair, there was also, for example, problems related to VAT refunds, there were problems about whether there was SARS has been selected in its treatment of certain taxpayers. All of those issues were also dealt with and certainly will be taken up either as part of the process of good governance with the Inspector General, but certainly in processes that the Commissioner can be involved. So these are the issues that we'll raise. I won't repeat them in the discussion paper. I want to end by just pointing out that there were other recommendations that the Commissioner can outline related, for example, to procurement. They requested the Treasury, the Office of the CPO, to look at multi-stage procurement deviations from standard procedures, etc. As it noted, when, for example, a company like Bain or Gartner got their contract, it wanted the Treasury to learn the overall lessons and to look at these and develop stronger protocols. Just around procurement and also on the interaction between SARS and trade. I want to just end with a broader issue that I think is there for both SARS and government as a whole, is how to deal with international consultancies and agencies. There were many international consultancy and agency firms that legitimized the seizure of SARS. And I should add, even state-owned entities, as we've seen from some of the evidence that's already coming before the Sunday Commission. And that included a whole process for using these firms to justify the firing of key officials and also producing independent reports to protect those officials implicated in criminal activities. I would really recommend for members to read Chapter 3, which goes into shocking detail on the role of Bain, including secret meetings a full year before the previous commissioner was appointed. They were having meetings with him to prepare him to take over as a commissioner 1 year before it was even made public. And I should add, maybe it might have changed, but I don't think when Bain wants, it's a U.S. company, I don't think when they want a contract from the federal government, they visit the home of the U.S. president to secure such work. But maybe they're going to play golf at Mar-a-Lago, I don't know. But I'm sure even if they try to do that, they will not just be breaking they're not just broken, by the way, South African laws. I believe that they've broken even US laws like the Pot and Corrupt Act. So when we're following up, it's not just with the NDPP, as we are in the process of doing, but we will follow up with foreign governments to see whether companies like Glen broke their laws and to provide them with the evidence. Glen did not cooperate with the Commission, and the Commission recommended that the NDPP consider prosecutions with the awarding of the contract to them. I should add that there were other international companies also involved, be they consultancies, technical ones. I think like on IT they had Gartner, there's Hogan Lovells who did a report on transgressions related to the FIC Act with one of the senior managers at SARS. And I should add that these international companies really employ double standards. They use their international brand to secure work in South Africa, so they have very high ethical standards. And then when they're in trouble here and their transgressions come out, then suddenly the headquarters says, no, they're a separate entity, they have nothing to do with that work, and so on. We don't buy that story, and it's certainly something that even as national government, we are looking at the use of these agencies. I believe they add almost no value. In fact, they add real negative value. So it's an area that really needs to be taken up, not just within South Africa, but to pursue them in their own home countries. Chair, I'll end with just a map just to show you the character of tax administration, the 15 tax. When we do the discussion paper, we will, for example, the thing with the tax collector is that in all countries you really only have one main tax collector. And it's not like, you've got to compare how other countries do it. That's the only examples we have. So we'd be looking into those areas. So, Chair, thank you. That's our presentation for today.
Thank you very much, Mr. presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just start by introducing some of my colleagues at the far right. We have Mr. Wayne Burton, who is a Senior Specialist Legal. Next to him is Ms. Mandisa Mbekene, who is Executive Business Support, also heads up the SARS Secretariat. And I've just recently asked Ms. Mbekene to work in my office specifically to head up an organization-wide program that we've initiated in support of gender-based violence and abuse by men. So she's brand new in that role. Mr. Johnson Makubu, you've met before, is our Chief Financial Officer. And then on the far left is Mr. Sipiti Sabeko, who is Group Executive International Relations, Media and Communication. Let me get straight into the presentation. You're going to have to watch me. Give you a quick presentation outline. I'll cover those events as quickly as I can so that we do allow for questions by the committee later. This just recaptures the summary that Mr. Mamoniat has already referred to. I'd like to just draw attention, I think, to the last two bullet points on that slide, which is really a decline in employee morale and confidence and a decline in hard-won public confidence in SARS. Those two may just appear there as two bullet points, but in essence, it speaks to the fabric of the organization. Not just its technical capability, but the commitment and engagement of our staff in order to ensure that we have a revenue authority and customs authority that can act professionally, ethically, and beyond reproach. And clearly, the work of building public confidence is central to our work because regardless of how many technical competencies we have, if the public does not have confidence in SARS, then it compromises the work we do, and I will refer to that quite often in the presentation. I will now deal with each of the areas in turn. On the slide, I just give us a quick cross reference where in the Nugent report you will find the specific detail. But as a result of the findings, we were required in conjunction with National Treasury to look at the policies and procedures to see if there were any areas of abuse. Specifically, Practice Note 3 talks to projects that are contracted as multi-phase projects and therefore does lend itself to scope and other variations which may be abused, and then also other areas where we had to review our standard operating practices. Specifically, we were asked to review a debt contract and the IT contract that we administer to look at the validity of those contracts, including whether the necessary disclosures and conflicts of interest were raised and adequately managed. Also, whether in fact, arising from those contracts, SARS derived value for money. Also arising out of the Commission of Inquiry to consider the referral of Bain and other contracts to the Directorate for the DPCI and the NDDP, and to consider whether there are other matters that they need to answer to. So, just the actions against that, I'm pleased to report that in regards to policies and procedures, National Treasury, in reviewing Practice Note 3, found that it is actually not deficient, it is adequate, and the risk lies in its implementation. And so SARS has also reviewed our own internal procurement policies and aligned it to the directive, and clearly will be alert to ensure that in fact our practices support the policies and support the intent of Practice Note 3. In reviewing the contracts for value for money, the IT contracts that were reviewed had been set aside, or rather no action was required to set aside the contracts because those contracts had run its course and were already lapsed. And the similar action on the debt contract because those contracts had also lapsed. In terms of value for money, we have engaged and are currently still engaged with our legal teams to address the specific questions of whether in fact those contracts delivered value for money and whether in fact the disclosures that were made allowed for the necessary management of conflicts that may arise from that. The Bain contract, we can confirm, we have referred to the DPCI, the Directorate of Priority Claims Investigation. We did so in April 2019. We are currently at an impasse with Gartner in respect of the value for money conversation. They deny that our position, that there was in fact no value for money. And so we're also referring that contract to the DPCI as well as continuing the negotiations for them for some recourse around payment. To continue the procurement next steps, we are engaging with the Chief Procurement Officer at National Treasury to conduct an overall procurement and governance review at SARS. We initiated this in June because we want to ensure that the integrity around procurement governance is tightened so that we don't create the opportunity or an ongoing risk for executives, including senior executives like myself and others, to manipulate this. I think we need to ensure that that the integrity of governance processes prohibits that. In respect of the Bain and Gartner matters, we obviously also are concerned about that and are recommending to National Treasury that there be serious consideration for those suppliers to be placed on the restricted suppliers list, which, if approved, will mean that government may no longer do business with suppliers that are listed. The decision ultimately will be National Treasury's, but we're making a strong recommendation in that regard. We also believe that it's a good time to review a number of our significant contracts to ensure that, in fact, we can assure ourselves that we are receiving the benefit for which those contracts are intended. In as far as referring the matters to the DPCI, we are awaiting feedback from them. I then move on to the organizational design and staffing. And again, for reference, it's the Nugent chapters are highlighted there, chapters 4, 5, 6, 7, and 13, for easy reference. And I will deal with those matters one by one. What happened following the Bain operating model review, which we now know, served no true business purpose, but served to weaken the capability of SARS to administer its laws. I must add that the large business unit or the large business center is a practice that is internationally recognized as the way to manage large corporate taxpayers. Large corporate taxpayers and wealthy individuals represent the highest revenue opportunity to the fiscus, but also represents the highest risk to the fiscus. The idea behind the large business center, therefore, is quite central to the success of the Revenue Authority, and it creates a end-to-end service, a one-stop value proposition to taxpayers, also to engage with them, to build professional relationships for them when matters arise that need to be resolved, but also in enforcing our laws that we have the appropriate capabilities and skills to do so. The compliance unit is another unit that is central to the success and for ensuring that there are internal compliance within our own practices. The High Court Litigation Unit, also with the Bain Operating Model Review, was disaggregated and distributed across the organization, so lost its impact. And the High Level Integrity Unit also disappeared, like the Compliance Unit, as a result of the Bain Operating Model Review. And I will turn to each of those in terms of where we are on the actions. On the staffing, Nugent raised a big concern on the appropriate level of competence, specifically for the IT team. The committee members will appreciate that the success of technology is central to the success of SARS and to the ability that SARS has to provide a seamless and simple service to taxpayers to comply, but also the ability to keep track and to manage all of our outputs with a high level of integrity. And therefore, not having suitably qualified IT staff at SARS is a big risk. We've also had to deal with multiple resignations that left since 2014. I had mentioned earlier that almost 3,000 staff had left the organization since 2014. 2,200 of those staff were resigned. Another 550 or thereabout retired. 32 had deceased at the time of reporting this, and many others ended up misplaced or declared basically redundant in the organization. I will address the EXCO matters as well as the reward and benefits of senior executives. On the organizational design, as I said, the large business unit, the whole idea behind that was to give SARS the capability core to delivering its function in an area of high opportunity and high risk. The Bain operating model review ensured or allowed that the what was created in 2004 as a single office end-to-end with the capability to address both the service and enforcement mandate was then again disintegrated and disaggregated across the organization, thereby significantly reducing its capability and its ability to render the service. What has happened up until now, a multidisciplinary project team has been appointed and is working towards a full re-establishment of the Large Business Center. We have appointed an acting chief officer together with an interim management committee to oversee these operations, and we are busy consolidating the functions as is required. The final engagement, whilst that is ongoing, we've already begun to engage with large businesses and high net worth individuals to live up to the value proposition as it was intended, as we are rebuilding the relationship towards building a culture of voluntary compliance. The committee will appreciate that just re-establishing the unit is fairly easy because you congregate people in one place, but to retool and repurpose and re-conscientize it to work will be hard work, and that work is currently taking place. We are in the process also of finalizing the structure, both at the main center in Sandton, as well as regional centers in some of our big areas like the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. In the rest of this year, we will also look to finalizing leadership appointments. The compliance unit, as I said, which disappeared under the Bain operating review model implementation, it basically seeks to ensure and help us manage compliance level across tax sites, across regions and across industries. It is the core piece of work that we require as we design and calibrate our compliance program, which is really our program of work that we table in National Assembly on an annual basis, but also gives us a five-year vision of the areas that we will focus on. So this unit now has been re-established, its mandate re-clarified, and clearly, again, it is now in the process of ensuring it has the right capability and capacity to give effect to its work. We are also required to ensure that the compliance program is in support of a new strategic intent. I shared very briefly at our earlier engagement the high level of that strategic intent, and that will form the basis of our strategy presentation, which we will bring to this committee in the October sitting. And so that work continues. The High Court Litigation Unit, we are in the process of restructuring and reconstituting that in order to allow us to more promptly and more efficiently deal with significant High Court litigation. We mentioned in a previous discussion that we have over 30 billion of assessments that are currently in dispute with taxpayers. Many of them will be large taxpayers and wealthy individuals. And somehow we have to make progress with this and either decide to litigate them or sit around the table and have settlement discussions as is permitted in terms of Section 88 of the Act which we administer. But we can't just keep rolling it. We need to bring certainty where we can set legal precedent and resolve disputes, but we also need to make sure that monies that are due to the fiscus are in fact collected. And so the work of the litigation unit, which is at the tail end of our value chain, is very important. Clearly, they will work very closely with the large business center and with enforcement, as I said, which is where their work really arrives. And so really the intent is to ensure more integration with the core business, as well as the ability to respond more appropriately and rapidly and to decide whether legal action is taken. This work was also disaggregated and left to the decision of auditors and senior managers, and not necessarily as well coordinated as it should be. So in May 2019, the decision was to reconstitute the unit. And again, this is international best practice that informs us, and this work will continue, and we hope that by October the unit will be at least ready to present a minimal viable proposition for us to roll it out. I mentioned the high-level integrity unit, which sadly also disappeared as a result of the Bain operating model review. The central function of this unit was to ensure that internally we develop, monitor, and ensure the highest level of integrity standards. And again, the members will appreciate that integrity is central to building public confidence, and SARS cannot be questioned by the public in terms of how it approaches its work, and therefore such a unit serves very important purpose towards our compliance program. And so in line with the Commission's recommendation, we are currently embarking on an effort, firstly, to set the tone and to highlight and amplify the desired culture that is required, and then this unit will serve to enable, support, and catalyze that. Currently, it is housed in the Human Resource Division, but it should be appropriately reporting directly into the Office of the Commissioner. And so this work will take place, and hopefully by November 2019, again, we will have the unit functioning. Turning now to staffing matters. This is an important area of work for us. I mentioned already, just in respect of information technology, how a deficiency here compromises the successful execution of our strategy and our vision, as well as the delivery of our compliance program. And so right from the level of executive leadership through to the technical skills, it's an area where we have brought about some temporary stability by filling in key positions with experienced IT professionals, some of whom are acting. It also allows us to complete the work of Vision 2024 and the new strategic intent, and that will allow us to further clarify the exact nature and level of capability and capacity that we are required in terms of our five-year plan. This work will be finalized in October 2019, and then also we will be able to formalize the resourcing of the this division, which looks at information strategy and technology towards the end of this year. The report highlights that as a result of a number of things, both deliberate and implied because of a change of culture. For example, we have mentioned before that 60 highly skilled senior executives were simply displaced and moved into supernumerary positions, which in common English meant that they did nothing or they did work that was meaningless. I have met with each of these individuals, re-engaged them, and reassigned them to meaningful work. In some cases, work that was very similar to the work they did before, and in other cases, where those jobs no longer exist on our organogram, in the meantime, assigned them to projects and work that that will add value as we define a new organizational structure. The Commission also said we should look more broadly at staff that have been hurt, either professionally or emotionally, through this process, and look for ways of reparation, not necessarily in financial terms. Some just, it may be a simple acknowledgement and an apology. Some have moved on in their lives. They wouldn't want to return to SARS. But many of them also, there may be an opportunity for them to be re-engaged by SARS. And so this is an organization-wide program that we are leading to ensure that misplaced employees are reassigned to meaningful work and where possible reinstate them into roles that they were displaced from. We've also had to adjust our recruitment policy to allow for the recruitment of staff who have left the employment since 2014, some of which happened through Section 189 or the reorganization provision in the Labor Relations Act, and others left of their own volition because they no longer felt that SARS provided them with a home professionally. And we've needed to adjust our policy because our policy at the moment, the standard policy, is vacancy driven and requires a particular recruitment process, and where necessary and where we have people that are known to the organization, have worked there before, we decided that a new provision would serve that purpose better. Notwithstanding that, we will still go through the normal vetting process and have created an internal review process and governance process to ensure that that's appropriately used. I then move to the EXCO. This is new with reference to EXCO members that were appointed since 2014. There were a number of questions around the regularization or the irregular appointment by EXCO members, and also that the EXCO members at the time were, for various reasons, which many of them have to answer to, became compliant with the decline of SARS. So what is happening is that when I arrived at SARS, I said that I am pausing the existing EXCO until we've been able to deal with all of the matters and questions that related to the Executive Committee. I commenced a review of the current chief officers as well as the broader group executives to ensure that when we reconstitute the leadership team, that we have individuals who are competent to operate in terms of the technical and professional requirements of the discipline which they lead, but also they have the necessary attributes to serve as members of an executive who have both fiduciary as well as enterprise responsibility in addition to their narrow technical responsibility. And so this requires a particular orientation which we cannot overlook. And so that review process is underway, and we will report as we go along with that. The committee may also be aware that some members have been suspended precautionary, and we're engaging in disciplinary processes to deal with that. Clearly, we have to wait also the outcome of those processes before we can reconsolidate a leadership team. National Treasury will provide further clarity around Section 18.3, which is the section in the Act that gives the Minister power to appoint to determine the conditions of employment of the Commissioner and the Executive Committee subsequent to their appointment. At the moment, however, we have decided to take the more prudent assumption and apply the strictest interpretation of section 18.3, which means that I'm already referring to the minister when approving salary increases and bonuses for those who report directly to the commissioner. The work to build a new leadership team is hard work, but the most important work of any leader is to ensure that there is a strong leadership team, and this leadership renewal and engagement program is currently underway. So I think the next slide I've effectively spoken to, and hopefully in the second half of this year, financial year, we can work to some level of convergence, to ensure that towards the end of the year we have at least a substantive semblance of a new leadership team within SARS. Referring to further operational matters, Nugent references chapters 8, 10, 11, 12, and 14, which covers illicit trade, VAT refunds, litigation, settlements, and case selection. I will turn to each of these in turn. In respect of illicit trade, which is a huge concern for SARS, and I have to say we have seen a significant proliferation of syndication, of illegal activities, of organizations that are created purely to defraud the fiscus. It's a huge area of focus for us, and it is well within our mandate to pursue this. And so in line with the review of the work we do, we've re-established the capability and the capacity to investigate illicit trade, and as part of the refinement of the model, we'll re-establish a division within SARS, a unit within SARS that will focus on that, but we don't have to wait for the formalization of that to advance the work. This work straddles also both our tax and our customs area, because often these illicit and syndicated activities are deeply entrenched in the entire value chain from the ports of entry and beyond, and certainly once it comes through our borders, the level of abuse to both mask the true customs and true tax obligations is rife. The focus is on tax implications of organized crime and syndicates. It is looking at complex and deliberate schemes to evade tax. We are focusing on a number of industries. Tobacco and cigarettes is a big area of abuse currently, which compromises the fiscus significantly. Cash and carry, clothing and textile and alcohol are some of the areas that we are focusing on. But ultimately, this will cover all sectors as we assess the levels of risk that are presented to us. Also of an area of concern is illicit financial flows. And where this manifests itself, Chair and members, is very often when large companies, including state-owned enterprises, when they place orders for significant procurement of large capital equipment, the Reserve Bank provision allows for those companies to pay out monies in advance, because often when you purchase capital equipment, there is cost incurred by the supplier in the procurement and the manufacturing of the raw materials, and this requires advance payments. So very often what a state-owned entity or a corporate would do is to apply for a value of, let's say, 100, pay out the 100, and then on receipt of the goods only declare 80 on the customs declaration, which gives you a sense that there's some corrupt intent that would explain the difference between the 100 and 80. And very often it is a simple case of fraud, of an illicit financial flow or money laundering to get money off our shores without any commensurate value. And so we work with the Reserve Bank in terms of that area. Phoenixism, which is really just a proliferating of a practice where entities conduct trade through a particular organizations conduct trade through a legal entity who then perpetrates or incurs tax liability, often fraudulent, and before you can go after them, they collapse that entity, create a new entity, and carry on the same business, but in successive entities which are then collapsed so that they can avoid or evade, in fact, their legal tax obligation, but also to mask the activity and to make it complicated for the revenue authority, but also the law enforcement agencies to pursue them. And then, as I said, syndicated fraud. You will not believe there are companies created purely for the purpose of creating that fraud, with no other commercial reason. And this is a huge area that literally siphons off money from the fiscus. Just to give the committee some update, we are currently involved in 17 projects and some 700 audit cases that we are currently pursuing, with a value compromise in our initial estimate of about 30 billion. We also have started a very constructive, collaborative project with the Minister of Trade and Industry, the DTIC, to improve the integrity of border declarations, but also to manage the entire value chain better. And there are many examples which, if we had more time, I could take the committee through. And we are seeing some early successes of that collaboration. VAT refunds, as I mentioned before, is an area of abuse, and therefore, important that we manage this within a very tight governance process so that there's no abuse either way, either by paying out the VAT, which should not be paid out, or withholding a VAT refund, which lawfully should be paid out. This specific matter was raised in the Nugent report, and therefore the entire governance process had to be reviewed. And so we can safely say that effective 1 October 2018, we no longer apply any artificial limitation of refund targeting. When a refund is payable, it is paid, and when it's due, it's effective. Equally, when we believe we need to do more risk work on it, we need to do that risk work, but within the parameters that are prescribed. The resultant action has also meant that we are now creating fewer audit cases, but also we have paid out some 30 billion of higher refunds in the last financial year compared to the previous year. Clearly an area that will enjoy continued observation by us and will be further reviewed and refined as is required. On litigation, this is a matter that's raised by the report as well, that there were examples of litigation and other costs that were incurred for personal interests. We have begun a process of engaging with the former commissioner to seek to recover monies we believe it's due to SARS, and we are awaiting progress and further updates on in that regard. In terms of settlements, one of the important areas of SARS, specifically vested in the power of the commissioner, is the decision and the discretion as to when to enter into a settlement discussion with a taxpayer where there is a significant dispute. And the law specifically provides for that, so that the commissioner may, in his or her discretion, and using the resources of the organization, make a decision as to whether to litigate or not. Litigation is often very costly, it's drawn out, and may have outcomes both in favor of a taxpayer or in favor of SARS. The choice of litigation is therefore very strategic, and there are instances where we need to set legal precedent, to give clarity. We will go all the way to a court, but settlement provisions is nonetheless a necessary part of the armory of SARS, but it's also important that the commissioner in his or her person protects the process and the integrity of that process by having a very solid governance process around that, with clear delegations of authority across the organization. And so what happened was that a new terms of reference was formulated, which would have given the commissioner single-handedly the ability to settle disputes over 100 million. Clearly a high risk. And I can say to you, as the current incumbent of this role, I would not take on such a responsibility to single-handedly decide on a settlement matter. It's just not good governance, it's high risk, and certainly not to be considered at all. Thankfully, this terms of reference was not approved because of the termination of the service of the former commissioner, and certainly we have no intention to have it approved. And so in fact what we are doing is reviewing all of our settlement committees to ensure that the appropriate delegations of authority and the appropriate governance is in place to protect the integrity of the process, advance the interests both of taxpayers, but balance that with the interest of the state. Case selection is an important area of our work, and this again is an important governance process to ensure that none of us wake up one morning and decide willy-nilly to go after a taxpayer or to target any specific individual for any other reason other than a tax risk. And case selection is important because all of our audit work, our investigative work, and ultimately our enforcement work derives its directional guidelines and input from the cases that we select. And therefore it's important that we have a high level of vigilance and diligence around that, whether it relates to entities or persons of ostensible wealth, but also just more broadly. And so a very important review of this area is necessary. We also have, on reflection, decided that at the moment our case selection methodology is too reactive and driven more by declarations rather than be responsive and proactive to what happens in the environment. And so we are also reviewing our case selection to be more proactive and responsive to risks that currently manifest in the environment, and to give clarity to that. For example, there's lots of evidences that arises at commissions of inquiry, lots of evidence that we read in the general public discourse, which may or may not present risks to the fiscus. It is incumbent on us to at least consider and evaluate that, and where necessary, direct our work to pursue those matters and ensure the recovery of money, and where necessary, the prosecution criminally of entities that may be engaged in such work. Moving into reputational matters, this covers certain media statements, our collaboration with other state institutions as well as international relations, very quickly, and I'm not going to go into the detail thereof, but there's adequate reference to this in the report. As I said, in Chapter 17, specifically media statements, Chapter 18 for our collaboration with other institutions, and Chapter 19, our relationship with more broadly. Here, this is specifically a matter that's involved in one of the disciplinary matters we are pursuing, but the engagement with media and public to restore public confidence is a matter of serious concern and ongoing work. In terms of the other institutions, as is required by the constitutional principle of cooperative governance, we have reached out to a number of state institutions. We are in various advanced progress to formulate a memorandum of understanding. In fact, last week we signed a memorandum of understanding with the SIU as well as with the NPA. And what this does is allow us, each within our own legal mandate, to be more collaborative, to leverage the resources of states, and to ensure that these matters are dealt with more expeditiously, because often when there is a tax offence that arises out of an illicit or fraudulent activity, there is necessarily also a further investigation of a criminal nature and ultimately prosecution, hence the need for us to work together with our colleagues in government. In terms of international relations, it's important for an organization like SARS, as Mr. Mamoniak said, there is no other equivalent organization within the country, and therefore benchmarking and cooperating with organizations such as the OECD, the World Customs Organizations, the Africa Tax Administration Forum, and other organizations are very important, because we share information, we collaborate efforts, we enter into mutual administrative agreements, we enter into information exchange agreements, into double tax treaties, and so for SARS to be respected and productive and active as a member of this international community is central towards the effective and efficient administration of our local mandate. And so very slowly we are re-establishing these relationships, much to the delight of these institutions, and so attending these meetings and engaging in collaborative work is very important for us. I'm moving towards the end now. I want to just spend a minute, Chair and members, on the rebuilding of SARS, and make the point that, you know, when you read the Nugent report, in Afrikaans they say papier is geduldig, paper is patient. I have to say to you, the organization is impatient. The pain and trauma that people experience is real. When you look into their eyes and you listen to them, you can sense that for them this is not simply a report. This is their lived experience. This is the trauma that they have experienced during this period. This is the unfortunate breakdown of trust between leadership and the organization, and the subsequent decline in morale alongside the erosion of capability and competence. And so the work of rebuilding SARS cannot be underestimated. It requires single-minded focus, persistent effort, as well as it will require time. Because on the soft side, it is about re-establishing what is the desired values and culture that the organization requires to do its work beyond reproach. What is the appropriate level of capability and capacity, starting with leadership, starting with the technical work of investigation and audit and other work, including the ultimate work of revenue management. It is about reconsidering what organizational arrangements will best serve the state in the sense where SARS can give effect to its mandate. It is about thinking ourselves from our current dilemma into the future, a future that is inspirational, that is exciting, and that serves the best interest of South Africa. And it is ultimately about rebuilding public confidence and trust. And I think we would like to give the members the assurance that this work has commenced, it will gain momentum, and with the support of other institutions and the support of this committee in no small way, we are confident that this work will achieve its objective. I thought while we are here to give you just an update on the tax season, the filing season. As you see there,
2 minutes,
I'm wrapping up, Chair. I think what's pleasing is that well over 2 million taxpayers have already filed, three quarters of them, their tax return have been processed within 3 seconds. That speaks to the functionality that we are able to provide. Many of them have, in line with our strategic intent, converted from the manual branch-based filing to one of our digital channels. We've also sent out a communique that says several or certain categories of taxpayers do not have to file. We've also been able to pay out over 10 billion of refunds and more than four-fifths or 80% of them have received their refunds within 72 hours. Also very pleasing that a recent South African citizen survey on the public confidence in SARS shows that the South African citizens have a 60% of them have a confidence that the institution under its current leadership can be trusted, which is 5% up from the same quarter last year. And this gives us encouragement that we are doing the right things and we're slowly rebuilding the work that is required of us. I'll pause there. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentation. It certainly does read like a horror story. I mean, what went wrong, but it is quite pleasing to see that there is progress. So it does look as if you're heading in the right direction. So that is pleasing. About 4 years ago, if you Google, it was all over the place that there was a, you know, pending collapse at SARS after Tom Miyagi came onto the scene. And you did mention briefly about the executives and their bonuses, but what I do want to know is what was the executive actually doing when it was falling over? Because, you know, they were there, or some of them were there, and what did they do, just stand by idly? But again, I was away for a few years, so maybe I missed something, but I want to know what they were doing. The SARG is never going to be independent if a political party crony get appointed commissioner, as was the case with Tom Miyagi. Now, Tom Miyagi should be in prison for what he did to SARG and the damage that he's done to the institution, and also the damage that he's done to our economy as a result of that. And you've been completely silent on the fate of Mr. Miyagi. I have not yet read this full report, which I will do, but what I want to know is what is happening to him. What is happening to this criminal that should be in prison? I agree that Bain and Gartner need to be held to account. Clearly what they appear to have done also appears to be criminal, and I think there should be consequences for them internationally as well. So I think, you know, whoever's going to throw the whole thing at them needs to do it quite firmly. But are there any other IT companies that were involved? When you talk about, on page number 6, when you talk about contracts, IT contracts that have lapsed, are these contracts that just fell away and there was no money paid, or were there other IT companies involved that essentially stole people's money through their activities? And then on slide number 12, on the large business unit, you mentioned rebuilding the relationships. Obviously, I can't think anybody would disagree that that's a vital thing because, you know, a lot of tax revenue comes from that. But exactly how do you rebuild the trust that was so badly damaged in this process? You did mention that 60% of the people that were called to leave that SARS is a reputable institution. I'm not sure who you're asking. I'm just wondering, in that particular category, the high network category. What specifically are you doing? Because I'm not so convinced that the reputational damage is undone, or maybe even getting undone. But it is vital that it happens. And then finally, on the illicit trade, on slide number 22, are you saying that SARS now does have the capacity to successfully investigate illicit trading and evasion? Thank you, Chair.
It's not used to you,
excuse me, thank you very much, Chairperson. Well, I wish to deal firstly with the claim in the Red Report or presentation, that the appointment of yourself was the most tragic. I think it's a very misleading comment, because well, firstly, it compares that transparency to other appointments in the past. But transparent means transparent. You know, the interviews were held in private. Nobody knows what questions these candidates are subjected to in what manner. If you wanted to build confidence, that's the first thing you do. You become transparent in the appointment process. And the basic definition is you hold those interviews in public. You know, many people who work in different institutions in society or in this government, particularly at the national level, are subjected to interviews where members of the media can actually come in. That was not the case here. So I don't know. That's the first thing. And we raised these questions, and they were never adequate answers. It's important to keep that in mind. Even if you want to do the right thing in the future, you probably want to hold an open interview, precisely to avoid the situation where someone like Moyane comes back. The second one is that Mr. Manuel recused himself. Why did Mr. Manuel recuse himself from the interview of the now appointed Special Commissioner? That's a it raises questions. In fact, we are told that he recused himself in the interview, but then participated in the discussions of whom has become the Special. So he did not leave the process. So if I'm conflicted, Comrade Chairperson, I must leave the process altogether. If a cousin of mine is there, I must say, look, this is my cousin, I don't want, we need to fix the reputation of staff. The very suspicion of conflict of interest, I don't want to be. So this idea that that you want to sell to us here in Monian, I'm not buying it. And those are the grounds upon which I'm not buying it. Maybe you want to tell us, why did the Manuel recuse himself? We are told that by anonymous sources that you are related to him, Mr. Keith Weber, somehow. Is that the case? Why are you accusing yourself? Why would you accuse yourself? It's out there in the public. And if people still doubt the appointment process and that you are friends and you are trying to run the staff as friends, that is just a new era of reputational damage you're engaging in. So you ought to come out very clear. That is my advice to you. You ought to come out very clear to clarify and not hide anything. If you are friends, you must tell us that. No, you're accused himself because Mr. Keith Letter is his friend or relative or whatever, his business partner or whatever. So I think that, in my view, the appointment process and left too many questions, at least which ought to be clarified. That's the first issue I want to deal with. Now, the second one relates to the road view. Do you know in the last argument there at court, By the way, at first there was no rogue unit. We used to be told there's no rogue unit, there's nothing rogue here, there is nothing in there. In all its evolution. Then there was, no, it's not engaged in any illegal activities, that unit. In the letter you wrote to us, Mr. Commissioner, when we asked you, does SARS have surveillance equipment that conducts or that are known to be intelligent, meaning intrusive surveillance equipment, you referred us to a case. I'm sure you're aware of that letter, of the public protectors in front of court, which is still to clarify whether SARS can engage in intelligence gathering or not. And I think it's dangerous. And that's the second thing that even the report you are speaking to did not look into, except to make an opinion. Nugget only makes an opinion that he does not think that unit was engaged in any legal activity, but did not look into it. And I argue that is the fundamental question of public trust, because to use SARS to either, you know, settle political scores or go for the people that disagree with you, the cloud surrounding the rogue unit relates precisely to that. If you do not break with that path, if you don't break with that path, by coming out very clearly, what happened? We don't even have to wait for a court decision on this matter. In my view, the legislation is very clear. But are you saying that you've got intelligence surveillance equipment or not? Do you have intelligence surveillance equipment or not inside SARS? Because at least according to the recent argument your representative lawyers were making there, you are admitting that there was a unit that was engaged in intelligence gathering. The last, the penultimate point relates to illicit financial flow. You know, we raised the question of illicit financial flow at the EFF in our first year of Parliament. President Mbeki then believed what was called the high panel report in relation to illicit financial flow, not just in South Africa, but in the entire continent, particularly in extractive industries. The biggest amount that are bleeding our taxes in South Africa, the biggest you've ever heard of, at least in as far as those independent research and that high panel report is concerned, are there in the extractive industry. To this day, I've never heard of a single company since Lonnie, and that was because of the work related to the Marikana Commission. I've never heard of any serious work that has been done in relation to illicit financial flows, particularly in the extractive industry. You know what happened? Every time you come here and say, we're looking into it. The other day we've been told that there's a unit now being established. I think it's a comment we want to put out there that you could actually do much more than have the money to run South Africa that you need, whether it's a trillion or three, I don't know what you need these days, but there in the extractive, there's too much criminality happening. And if you can catch the big fish, the small fish, you know, will comply. Everyone will comply. If you can catch the big fish, and those are multinational companies that hemorrhage South African taxes without any consequences, as it were. So I think that there has to be much more concrete policy work there. There has to be much more concrete unit for me, even in the units that you probably need an independent unit related to catching illicit financial flow. Not illicit trade, that's something else. There's a specific program, even accounting companies, by the way, advertise how we can help you avoid paying taxes as multinational companies. That's different to illicit trade. Okay, the last point. Relates to the question of the Inspector General. I did not understand if you came out clearly there. Because the report makes mention of the position of an inspector general to enhance the governance at SARS. Can you just give details what exactly, I may have missed it, but is there any progress in relation to that recommendation? And if so, what are the specific details? A closing comment, Chairman. I think it's well said that the Director General of the Minister is not here in relation to such an important report. And we must take exception to that. Someone senior from the department, from the ministry staff, should have been here. Either the Finance Minister himself. I think we must take exception to that. They should be here to come and deal with the issues that are being raised by the two presentations. They should have been the ones presenting, the Director General or the Minister of Finance. They should be here. In my view, I think we must take exception to that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Scotsman.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I'm going to speak after the two doctors have spoken. Dr. George and Dr. Joseph. Yeah, no, Honorable Chair, we welcome the presentations, both presentations from the National Treasury and also from SARS. First with the presentation from the National Treasury, I want to commend, the decision taken by the Cabinet in welcoming the report and also outlining steps that they are going to take in making sure that they deal with the recommendations from the Nugent Commission, which include the issue of publishing a discussion paper later this year for public comment on strengthening governance, organizational design and accountability as far as and also on the potential role of the IG compared to the board. But also the document that will also deal with the issue of clarification of the role and the powers of the tax ombud, and also the issue of producing the SARS amendment bill. I think those are very key issues to me, which I think they are going to assist us, I think, moving forward in addressing these particular challenges that we are facing. But just one question of interest, which might almost be similar to what the Honourable Jose have asked, but maybe I'll ask it differently. I think you made mention here that the Commission, you said that the DTC previously recommended that we should establish an oversight board, SARS oversight board. However, the Nugent Commission is not in favor of that particular recommendation. Instead, it's in favor of the recommendation of establishing the Inspector General. Now, I want to find out, maybe just to give us more details, to see what were the reasons from the, or what was the motivation from the DTC to recommend that let's have an oversight board. Because it looks like those reasons were not convincing enough to the Nugent Commission. Hence, the Nugent Commission is not in favor of the oversight board, but instead is recommending that let's have an inspector general. So what might have been the motivation from the DTC to say let's have an oversight board? And then coming to the presentation from SARS, I think we're looking at this matter for the first time, Commissioner. I think this is our third engagement in this kind of administration, I think, where you were breaking up, though you were not detailed, I think, in the two previous encounters. But I think we did, in both encounters, we did highlight the some of the recommendation from Nugent Commission and as to how far are you in terms of implementing it. And I think we really comment that and we believe that, like you have said, I think in your first slide or in your second slide, that this recommendation according to assist to restore a decline of employee morale and confidence, and also restore a decline in the hard-won public confidence in France, and also going to address the issue of a massive failure in government and integrity. I think so we really commend you on that. But also the issue, I think your decision to refer the issue of paid contracts and of the Gardner matter to the Directorate of Public Crime, I think it's also assisting. I think we really welcome it, and we believe that it's going to assist. Hopefully, I think in your next encounter with us, I think we will be briefed as to how far is that particular process. Because issues like this must not just talk about and share that. We need to get an update timely as to what is happening with them. And also the issue of reviewing contract for value for money. I think that's also very positive. I think part of our responsibility is to make sure that we get value for money. Such money must not be used, must not be misused. We must always make sure that we get value for money. But as we do that, just to caution that process needs to be handled with care. To make sure that everything that is done becomes above board, to avoid complaints or accusations that people might say that no, there's a wish harm here because now there's a new commissioner, looks at people for contract under the leadership of the previous commissioner, they are now being removed. So we must just make sure that the process is a good initiative, but let's just make sure that the process is intended with care, everything is above board. And my last point is also to commend the process that we have initiated of reviewing the terms of reference on the issue of settlement, reviewing the terms of reference that placed the authority to settle disputes of over 100 million rands solely in the hands of the former commission. I think that is a very positive. We really commend on that. So I think, let me stop for a moment.
Thank you, Chair. For me, the organization that was, able to meet is okay. On this last slide, you're talking about the building of staff. But I just want to say, what you are doing now, as you've been presenting, I think I really would like to commend you. You are doing a good job. And you are talking about that you need to stay persistent in time. For me, you've already started. You know, on that slide 17, the one that you go for the people that have been replaced, you go to them, you recruit them back, you train them. You know, that is, I've never heard of any company ever doing that. Even going home just to go and get paid, you are doing great. And I would like to commend you for that. If you can continue to do that, and then if the organization is starting to work and everybody is in place, then all these other initiatives things, I think they're going to be easy for you to do that. And on the first, my comment also on the first presentation. On this slide, you know, I wrote taxpayers' rights versus a governance of I think it was easy because the ombuds, tax ombuds, you are saying, you know, the just concentrate on taxpayers' rights. But how is it possible that if they come in, they do not temper with governance? So what you need to do is to sit down with them and discuss this thing so that you don't cross the line. This is where you end. But I was just laughing when you said, how possible is that? But you are doing a good job as well.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe let me also take this opportunity to appreciate the input both by National Treasury and the staff commissioner. Commissioner, the COVID, I think we can be unanimous in saying that
to appreciate that certain categories want to submit or sign something. But that it was so far. Chair, my question to Mr. Momo is on the issue of time, because I have a sense that National Treasury seems to be treating the challenges and staff as a business as well. I'm saying so because we don't seem to be getting timelines in terms of when that is going to happen. Yes, you are saying that you are busy with a discussion paper that should come out before the end of the year, but even then, Mr. Momo, our interest once again is to have a sense of the involvement of taxpayers in that discussion, because we need to hear what the people say, and that should come out in the in what we are crafting as a department. Of course, involved in the discussion is the issue the members have spoken about, the powers that lie within power versus the limited powers within the ministry. And I think the process of restructuring power should move a bit faster, and we should be able to say by a particular time this has happened. We know that with a working institution like SARS has a responsibility, okay? We won't have an end to problems as such, but the current restructuring should have some timeline as to when it will start happening. Today, I appreciate the presentation of the commissioner. It's not an easy task, and I don't want the commission to do any witch hunting, but you should also appreciate that those who comply with the former powers that they were doing so because they were the authority at the time. We should not continue as though in fact we are only dealing with victims. There are some of those who were cooperating, but we should also understand, have a way of understanding and accommodate the way they acted to a point of risk giving to a particular my question really is where does power lie right now, as you speak? I heard you in the 25th slide talking to the 100 million, for example. And we know, for example, what the Women's Commission has recommended. But who calls the shots, as you speak? That is my other question. I am also interested to know what is the legal status, or I don't want to break English because my major is in English, so I don't want to be a kind of teacher who is not a but I want to agree a bit with the circle. Okay, because you know, we need to know what is the progress now in terms of persecution, if there are any. But the rare case is concerned, the Mapapa case, could you brief the committee on that? What is the progress in that? There's an area, a grey area, in the taxation of people in business in our country. And unfortunately, it is an area that is killing the nation, the area of drugs.
And I see that we have research concerns about it. And I want to believe that tobacco is multifaceted. You can have your BB, your boxer, your cigarette, and so on. But where do we place these toxic drugs? Because they are there somewhere, but they are loosely there. But we know for a fact that people who make serious money are people who deal in drugs. So what do we do about that? Are we just dealing with registered companies? And what do we make of the money that's flowing in the street and illegally so? Can we take that? What is it that we are doing about it? Second thing, one of the persons has spoken about the true contract. I also wanted to check what the process or the progress is in terms of your Bain and Gartner contract, because we're talking now like 4 months or so down the line. We're talking April 2019, talking four months down the line. So what is the progress there? Can you answer? My second last question is around slide 11, where the commissioner, then in terms of the next step, you want to have engagement with large businesses. Yes? What are you looking at specifically? When you say large businesses, what do you have in mind? And you also say high network individuals. Some comrades here will come tomorrow and say, yeah, you are involved in so and so. So can you take us into confidence as this committee and tell us who are you intending to network with when you say high network individuals? I'm not necessarily looking for names here, but I'm looking for specifics. As I said, it was 11 and 12. So in 12, in terms of your next step, you are saying you look at expanding the unit's resources and capabilities. How do you intend doing that? Where are the resources going to come from? Chair, maybe just lastly, as a matter of clarity, there are these relations that are there that the commissioner wants to rebuild. And we appreciate that because we are not a country in an island or in isolation. We want to have these relations. But they're all abbreviated there. We'd like to know who they are in full. In full.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'll, and thanks for the questions from honourable members. I'll start with there were a few that were quite cross-cutting, so let me just deal with the cross-cutting and then I'll deal with the other issues raised. I think, Chair, on the issue of prosecution, you know, it's like, I think what I was saying with Steinhoff, we have a number of cases, whether it's Christina Daly, BDS, SARS, you know, there's a number of cases. We are working with the authorities, both the Hawks and the NPA. It's obviously not, you know, we can only provide the info, how they follow up. And I can assure you that there's a lot of follow-ups in terms of providing affidavits, providing information, and so on. And we are equally frustrated that, you know, no one has been challenged yet on some of these core crimes that were committed against our people. Let me say that there's no doubt that the last few months we've had very positive interactions with our own MPA. And I saw, for example, Mr. Toh on TV, I think it was on Sunday night, you know, just pointing out they have to get the case, they have to get the evidence. And I'm no lawyer, so I don't want myself know exactly what evidence is required. But I think whether it's the Mayani case, Makwakwa, Amsaz, all of that information is being provided. I think the Nguyen report provides a very rich source of information. We are also just talking to the agencies to remove any constraints they may be having in terms of resources and so on. It's not an area I deal with, but I know those discussions are taking place. So, yes, I think the only way you really know is to call up those agencies on that, but I have a sense that there are, there is movement, and I feel a bit positive that something should happen. I think when it gets to also others like Bain and so on, there's no doubt, I have no doubt, as a layperson, that they too should be charged. And I believe there's ample evidence. And again, even in those instances, even as we speak, we are preparing affidavits to provide even more information. We don't have to provide those affidavits, but to the extent that they need evidence, we are doing so. So I think that's all that we can say, because once we provide the info, we don't, obviously, we don't interfere with the process. It's up to the relevant agencies to decide how to proceed, whether to charge, whether they need more info. It's their issues. I think, too, that I would really want to recommend that members read this report. It's quite an easy report to read, and it's not too thick. You don't have to read all the annexures, okay? That will go into a lot. And it does answer a lot of the questions. And yes, not all questions are fully answered. So let's say, the questions related to the Inspector General that Honorable Ngozi and others asked. That concept was a new concept, even for us. And I think, that you asked, there's difficult issues like, you say, taxpayer rights, governance, and of course, even where we sit, if we can merge these institutions and have one doing everything, we'd be very happy. But they have pointed out that you can have a board, but because of, for example, confidentiality arrangements, there are limitations to what a board can do. And so, for example, when they look at, I don't know what page, so I had Malekhan look at, I forgot to introduce, that was very rude. On page 179, they look at, for example, what the Davis Tax Committee has said. They've applied their mind, yet they've come with a different perspective. And they feel quite strongly about the role of the Inspector General. What we are doing is, and under Ngozi, there's no, there isn't full clarity yet on exactly beyond the broad perspective that they provide, what they need to do in the nitty-gritty. That is why we have the discussion paper that we prepared. And I am happy that you are imposing timelines on us, Honorable Aiden, because we have been taking too long. And, even Cabinet was more optimistic when we should provide it, and we are, to be honest, running late. We hope to present it by the end. We will present it by the end of October. Okay, so that's the first deadline. And the idea is that would go into what are the roles of the tax ombuds, what's the role of the board, if you have a board, what's the role of the Inspector General? How do these, you know, there may be areas where of intersection between them, and underlying it, how do you deal with taxpayer rights? How do you deal with governance? So the questions you ask, I think, are exactly the hard questions we need to answer. So we're doing a bit more technical work so that by the time the paper is there, the choices are clear. That's the one area that government has to decide. So even in accepting the recommendation, it's open on those issues. And in terms of the process of consultation, what we normally do is you put out the consultation paper, then you open it up to the public, to taxpayers, to everybody. We get comments on the paper, then we come back and we say these were the comments that we were provided, and this is our response. And it would be good if you could come to the committee once when we have the paper to present it to you, and once you've had the public comments, we can come back and say these were the comments, or you may want to have a hearing as a committee on that. And once we have the response document, we will then start preparing the legislation. I don't think the legislation would be that difficult to prepare, but we could, you know, there's no reason why we can't item table it soon after the budget next year. So we're looking at February, March, so we can table it, and then the committee will have further hearings on that. So that it will be a deeply consultative process. I think Cabinet recognized that when it made that statement. And but the report does go into those details, and I would really recommend to members of the committee to go through the committee. I think just to, you know, no tax unit can operate without an intrusive arm. The commissioner can come in. On the one hand, they can't assume that everyone is crooked and won't pay their taxes. They have to rely on the fact that most taxpayers are honest. Most companies, hopefully too, are honest and provide. And that's why they have a risk engine, that if there's any grounds to feel that someone's not prone to honesty, that they have their mechanisms, as the commissioner has outlined, to focus on those. And the idea is that you do need to have an inclusive unit. Now, to what extent it should be intrusive and so on, the commissioner can deal with that, but and, you know, on the question of illicit trade, for example, you know, people who embark on these activities don't come and announce that they're doing something illicit. It's just been done. There were state-owned entities that were doing illicit trade or illicit flows of funds outside. There may be companies that are doing it. There may be criminal syndicates, drugs, etc. And it actually requires all the different players to come, which is those dealing with drug syndicates, whoever comes in will deal with it. Certainly the tobacco industry, illicit tobacco, is a huge problem. And those were, as the report outlined, deliberately weakened. So hence, the capacity to deal with illicit flows. On the one hand, you had that rhetoric with dealing with it, yet actually those institutions were deliberately weakened. And the Nugent Commission does in its report, I think from page 74 on the chapter 6, does go into this issue. And with all due respect, we differ with the approach that's been taken, to say SARS must have no intelligence capacity will render them to be useless. Okay, now, intelligence is not the type that this spooks to. I'm talking of intelligence where, for example, criminal intelligence, okay? And I think that I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to say this is right or that's wrong, but the Nugent Commission does go into it in some detail in Chapter 6 from page 74 onwards. And I would recommend that we engage over what they've outlined, and we're pretty confident that given where it's been challenged by the public protector, that we will certainly take the matter up legally through whatever mechanisms that are afforded, because it would be a terrible precedent to say that South can do, cannot do that. And I think part of the state capture story was what role the security trust could play, and itself may have been involved in illicit activities. So I think hopefully Judge Zondo can deal with it, but I think certainly where we sit as a treasury, the fact that SARS must have an intrusive capacity with real teeth is important. I think with regard to the appointment process, Chair, as you know, we dealt with that when we dealt with our budget, when the committee dealt with our budget. I think the same questions were asked from one of your colleagues in the party. I think there is adequately dealt with. I think they are in the report. And to the extent that people did so, well, it can go to court. But at the end of the day, the president is not obliged to follow that process. Those are just recommendations, ultimately whatever the process, recommendations that were made. In terms of who chaired the recusal, the commissioner can't really answer those. I was a member of the panel, so I have a bit more insight. But there is a report, and let's start with the report. It deals with all those issues, and I believe that, and in fact, the Nugent Commission said that the interview should be done in private. And I think that one can have a debate about, you can have television debates to interview candidates or not, what gives you a better outcome. The President followed the Nugent Commission's proposals to the T. So I think that those issues have been dealt with. I think it's not fair to say that people are relatives just because maybe they look similar or they're from the same race. I think that those have been proved to be nonsensical. I think Mr. Manuel took it to court and won on those issues. So it's all out there in the public record. But perhaps the commissioner can say who all his relatives are. I certainly don't know all my relatives, but he can vouch for his relatives. But I think certainly as treasury, we don't think that there's any merit in making those types of allegations, and it's not been fair to the commissioner. And I think it's important that we don't inadvertently undermine the credibility of SARS by making unsubstantiated allegations. I think, Chair, that when it gets to let me see if there's any other issues for the treasury. Is there any other issues, Mother? Just of the policy, the commissioner will then come in on the basic issues. I think I've dealt with the use of clothes, I've dealt with the... I think that with regard to Mr. Moyani, I think that too went through a long process. As you know, the challenge is in court. The presidency has issued the statement. Only the president has the power to appoint or to remove a commissioner. In terms of the issues that the Nugent Commission has raised, as I said, those are issues that we're talking to the criminal prosecution authority. We can't account for what they, how they take it up, but I mean, I've dealt with that point. So I don't think it's fair to ask the commissioner what's happened to his predecessor. I guess I've dealt with both of them, so I kind of know the issues in that respect. Chair, I think in terms of, I think that's answered most of the questions that were directed at the chair. If there's anything else, I'll come back after the commission.
Chair, just in response to the questions by Dr. George, first of all, thank you for your encouragement and support. We really need and appreciate that, Dr. George. What did the execs actually do? I think that's the subject of a current review. Nugent report says that they were largely compliant and served under the direction of the former commissioner, it would have been expected that they act independently as well and not just be compliant. And so sadly, there is a broader leadership accountability that has to be responded to, and that, as I said, is the subject of the current review. I will, in a moment, ask my colleague, Mr. Johnson, to speak to other IT contracts, but I'm going to deal with the LBC questions of relationship and trust and also respond to Honourable Abrams, your question. So, first of all, the current definition of a large business center is companies who have a turnover at group level of over a billion. But it's something that we can continue to review who is included, who is excluded, because the principal value proposition remains the same. And where we cut off is really a function of our capability rather than the definition. So, for example, one could also argue that you can have a similar focus on medium-sized businesses or small businesses because it follows a principle of a segmented approach. High net worth individuals, similarly, we will cut it off. There's no point in cutting it off, and, for example, everybody that has R1 million of assets if we can't cope with it. So we would cut it off, again, relative to our current capability, and we will review that on an ongoing basis. The second part of your question is the nature. So typically, large businesses would include multinational companies. So the financial sector has a big spread, and mining companies as well. But again, when we formulated the value proposition, when I was there the first time in 2004, it had a sector specific on manufacturing, construction, financial services, and primary sector, and other sectors. And as we develop this concept and build capability, we will review all of that in a new dispensation. I think what's important is the second part of your question, which is the nature of the relationship that we have. So these relationships are not meant to be cozy. They're meant to be helpful. They're meant to facilitate difficult conversations and to provide a service that seeks resolution in the most professional way. Our levels of engagement will be varied. It will, for example, when you go and speak to an industry sector group, it will include all banks, or all insurance companies, or all mining representatives. We speak with business organizations like BLSA and BUSA and others when we have concerns which we may believe cut across. And then we deal with specific taxpayers when a matter arises. But these are above board, transparent, we would always recommend that when the commissioner or any of the senior executives meets with an industry body or meets with, that it is done so in public, or if it is a private meeting, that there would be more than one person present, so that nothing, no risks are necessary. The survey, Dr. George, is not done by us. It's an independent survey by South African Citizens Forum. We welcome the encouragement that comes from that, but it's certainly not ours. I will deal with the illicit trade capability and also with Dr. Ndlozi's question on the so-called rogue unit matter. So first of all, let me say unequivocally that SARS in law is expected to gather intelligence, to do investigations, and to use whatever equipment it needs to gather that that intelligence in a way that it allows it to administer its act. There can be no, Dr. Ndlozi, there can be no question about that, and if there's any need for clarity, our opinions on this doesn't matter. We would have to go to court to get clarity on that, because each of us cannot interpret our law. Our current understanding is that the law provides. The difference is that we may do so only in pursuit of our mandate. In other words, we will not pursue a matter of national security. We will not pursue a matter that is outside of our mandate, that is within the mandate of another organization. So we are very clear about this. And what is important is that this is surveillance equipment. Okay? This is surveillance equipment. This is surveillance equipment. My eyes and my ears are surveillance equipment. The question is that surveillance equipment or intelligence gathering equipment per se is not lawful or unlawful, it is not covert or overt, it is how it is used that either makes it covert or overt. But in its definition, we have a range, you can laugh, it's fine, we have a range of equipment that we will use to gather intelligence on the specific matter that you raise. So I want to come back to Dr. George's point. If we double our capability and capacity, we'll do so much better. So you'll never have enough. And we started by assembling people who are in the organization at the moment and will continue to, as resources are available and as we begin to recruit, we will continue to expand and build that capability. In respect of the specific question about the existence of a unit, this is a matter that is currently engaged in through the public protector. It's a matter on record. I will not comment on that now. But suffice to say that our mandate is clear. We also are insistent that our staff executes our mandate in the most professional manner, in a manner that is beyond reproach. But clearly that will not always be popular, and it will not always be to everyone's interest, depending on whose interest is being shielded. So I think I've answered Dr. George. Dr. Ndlozi, you know, not everyone is happy that SARS is well functioning. Some people may feel threatened. Some people may feel that what happened in the last 5 years will no longer happen in the new dispensation. I can't speak to that, except to say that we will execute our mandate professionally, and you and others are perfectly entitled to hold us to account to do so. And we are going to submit ourselves to public scrutiny and to the oversight of this committee with the level of diligence that is expected. On the illicit flows issue, this is really illicit flows is within the mandate of the Reserve Bank. Where it touches us is in a particular investigation, as I mentioned, where there is a mismatch between a trade and the flow. Clearly SARS then becomes party to such an investigation. If there's any additional report or information you think that may help us in that regard, I would welcome it. So certainly feel free to give us the reference if you believe it will be helpful. Your comment around big fish, let me be very clear. We go after all fish, big and small. We don't think of them as fish, we think of them as taxpayers. And we will do so whether they are private or public. We have not any predisposition to be uneven or use different standards for public institutions or for private institutions. We are even-handed in the way that we administer the law. And as I said, we are prepared to be held accountable for the work that we have to do. Honourable Skosana, again, thank you for your encouragement and thanks for the work we do. It's hard work. We certainly will commit to give you an update on the matters that we've referred to the DPCI as it develops. We are very keenly following that as well. You advise us to handle with care the matters where we are pursuing value for money. Clearly these are commercial matters. We drive a hard bargain, but your advice is absolutely spot on. It should still be done professionally and sensitively, and we take that advice on board. In terms of the terms of reference for settlement committees, as I pointed out, it is in a way protecting ourselves by being clear about what we may and may not do. I can tell you, I think it is inadvisable for the commissioner, when he or she is presented with a matter, to say, just leave it with me, I'll take care of it. One has to question what the real motive or intent then is in that regard. So again, your advice is well placed. Honourable Mabletse, again, thank you to you for your encouragement. We really appreciate that. You know, you raised the point on people matters. People are very dear to my heart. Ultimately, we are people. You know, we have policies, we have laws, we have buildings, we have technology, but SARS is its people, as in any organization. We therefore take it very seriously. In addition to dealing with the specific matters raised in the Nugent report, I can give you the assurance that we will continue to provide support to all of our staff who may feel traumatized and create a voice, an opportunity for them to express their voice and to share with us. We have initiated a stream of work to review our entire employee value proposition and reinitiate an employee engagement program that we will commence in the new financial year. But we're doing some of the groundwork as far as that's concerned. You've also heard me earlier on say that we can no longer be silent and stand by whilst we have the current state of abuse of women by men in our country, but also violence that is perpetrated in our towns. And so we've taken a very clear stand. Last week I wrote a letter to our staff to set out very clearly where we stand on that matter. The letter I see has circulated in the public domain, but it is no secret, and as I said, I have asked our colleague Mandisa Mabikeni to help me so that we have a woman who understandably knows more about that than we would ever understand, and we would bow to that superior help that they would give us. But we are clear that we need to do more for our people and specifically more for our women. And there's a clear program of action that we will follow as far as that's concerned. But thank you for the encouragement. On balancing taxpayers with stakeholder rights, you can imagine that a taxpayer will always want more rights and the state will always want its rights. And it ends ultimately with us being even-handed, acting without fear or favour, without prejudice, in a way that is beyond scrutiny. And therefore we support the work that the Tax Ombudsman does, we support the work that the Public Protector does in this regard, we support the work that the Courts does, and we will always place ourselves subservient and subordinate to all of that. Honourable Abrams is not here.
Yes.
Oh, there she is. again, thank you to you for your encouragement. On the threshold, I just want to provide clarity. In terms of the current legislation, anyone earning under the age of 65 and earning up to 78,150 is exempted from paying tax completely. If you're older than 65 but under 74, no one in the room I'm sure, then that threshold moved to 121,000, and if you're over 75, like my mother and most of our mothers, I guess, that threshold moves to 135,000. The 500,000 threshold does not override this. It is not a tax exemption. It is a filing exemption. So what we say is we already have enough information to do your entire assessment without you having to submit a return. And so it is an exemption that we provide for those taxpayers below 500,000 who have a simple salary structure, who do not have to. But you remember, you already paid your taxes because of the employees that are deducted. So I thought that clarity would be helpful. Where do the power lie in settlement committees, Honourable Abrams? Ultimately, it can never vest in one individual. The law makes the commissioner the ultimate authority, but any sensible commissioner would surround him or herself with committees, with governance structures, whether it's a settlement matter or a procurement matter or any other matter. We have governance committees and structures to protect the integrity of the process. So while legally the power lies with the office, I think sensibly and for good reason, that power is distributed within governance structures that hold all of us accountable. On the Makokwa matter, obviously there's a matter that's currently with the Public Protector, which I will not speak to. On his separation from SARS, you may recall that the first disciplinary committee found him not guilty. A second round was then formulated, during which process Mr. Makokwa resigned. And on the taxpayer affairs, clearly we do not comment in public on specific matters related to taxpayer affairs. The matter that related to the recovery of money is advice that was paid for when dealing with when the former commissioner dealt with a matter with the FIC, and the matter broadly is also referred to the DPCI for further investigation. Your point about the cigarettes, you're quite right. It's more than just cigarettes and tobacco. So we publish our performance, but I can share with you just for some highlights, is that in the prior financial year, just on narcotics, we conducted 892 interventions valued at 535 million rand, just on narcotics. On cigarettes, 220 interventions valued over 50 million. On alcohol, 298 interventions valued at over 18 million. But the full list is published in our annual report. And clearly, these are of huge concerns. And so it's broader than just cigarettes. It covers all harmful substances that are either harmful to us from a health perspective or unhealthy from an economy perspective because they are illicit. What do we? I addressed. I think you were in the room when I addressed the large business center, the nature of the relationships. Additional resources. We will continue to recruit. We are currently engaged with National Treasury for additional resources for the next period. On your point of acronyms, I have a similar dislike thereof. We actually raised it in our preparation discussion. So I will never burden you with an acronym again. I think they are unhelpful. I think, Chair, I've covered most of the questions that have been asked.
Chair,
shall
I ask questions?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you. I think that I want to make a follow-up on two issues. The first one is that neither myself or the EFF makes the claim that Mr. Momonya, that the commissioner looks like Shabalala, or that because he is of a specific race, therefore he's related to Shabalala. We're not making that claim. I think it would be inconsistent with anything that was said. So the case is under appeal. And we will see if the judge this time who will hear us will give us an opportunity in camera to have our anonymous source give evidence. And so that one is fine. And I understand your response in relation to it, except I think it's completely inconsistent and wrong for you to actually do something we didn't say. That's Manuel's argument. It's not what he said. Even in the court that you are quoting, there was never such a thing that was. But let me tell you for free. Don't make a mockery of this question of intelligence. And don't insult my intelligence. As you and I are aware, both of us, there is specific equipment which is called intelligence equipment that conducts surveillance in an intrusive way. And there are companies that specialize in production of such equipment which is not available in the market because it's intrusive. If someone is in possession of such an equipment, you must answer yes or no. Particularly if you are consistent with saying that you subject yourself to the scrutiny of this committee, I ask a simple question and you make a mockery that your eyes are intelligence equipment. I think I take exception to that. I ask in a correct spirit. Now the second argument you make, that national legislation allows firms to gather intelligence, you are wrong. There's no such a thing. The Constitution of the Republic says only the President of the Republic can set up an intelligence division other than the intelligence services that have been done, that have been commissioned in crime and defense and state security, and must do so under legislation. So which legislation would be governing a division inside SARS that is engaged in intelligence gathering? Which legislation would be doing that? That's why there was a letter written to State Security, which was intelligence something back then, to get a collaboration. And when those people at the time came in, they realized that SARS was already engaged in intelligence gathering that is not within the law. That's number one. Yes, you can establish a division. That's not the argument. But it must be within legislation. It must comply with the Constitution. Why? Because somebody needs to hold you accountable. If you are busy spying on South Africans, everybody that is doing that in South Africa and crime intelligence comes to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence and gets to be held accountable there. Because South Africans have got rights. You can't go planting cameras in their private homes or private businesses. Even standing divisions in the country need a court order to do so. So don't turn this into a mockery. I'm not at that level, and I wouldn't want to reduce the conversation to that level. If the court is going to make any decision, it's not whether you can establish a division, it's whether you have a right to establish it without legislation, one, two, without the president. Because there's no evidence in front of court to that effect. That's really what I'm saying here. And I think that let's be on the same level. I don't mind. I mean, anyone in government who wants to go and enforce the law, you can do that. But you have to do it within there must be the mandate. What is it that you'll be doing? And you must do it within the law. Otherwise, you are engaged even in espionage, possibly. Because if you spy the president or the NPA offices, or I mean, those are deplorable acts. No government, no law abiding. Democratic government must ever allow that. So that's what's at stake here. That is what is at stake. If such an organization existed within SARS, I tell you now, your credibility is bothering on Civil Human Rights Foundation. You can't spy on me. It's not the right. Because I'm going to be scared to criticize you. I'm going to be scared to come to Parliament and hold you accountable. Because I know when I get out of here, you've got intelligence capability which is not governed by any law. The SARS Act doesn't make for such a provision like that. Period. Thank you.
Yes, of course. Chair, so let me just restate what I said earlier on, that SARS is well within its powers in terms of the SARS Act to gather information and intelligence in as far as it pursues a tax risk. We may not, and even in that regard, we have to do so lawfully. In terms of the matter which the public protector is currently pursuing, we have given our response to that, and we will abide by the outcome of the court in as far as the specific matter is concerned for the period that the public protector is reviewing. And if there's any further clarity around that, I said this is not a matter of opinion, we will be subject to the way the court declares on this. We are very, very clear, Dr. Ngozi, that we may not act outside of the law. We may only act within the law, but even more than that, we must act professionally and ethically. And so I have no problem with that. I have no problem with guidance and clarity that's given by any of the institutions that are created to provide that guidance and clarity, and I have no problem with the oversight committees that continually guides and nudges us in the right direction. I said earlier, we are perfectly aligned with that. SARS, you know, I don't know what you mean by spying, so I can't use that word. But as far as the gathering of information and intelligence in its broader sense of the word, as far as it relates to us pursuing a tax risk, as far as I understand, is permissible in law. I have Mr. Broughton there. I don't know if he wants to add anything to that.
Commissioner, the only thing that...
Why are they smiling at each
other? The only thing that I would add to that is that it's a debate, I think, that must happen around what is intelligence equivalent and what is not intelligence equivalent, and the scope within which you are able to use equipment that could be used for illegal purposes. But as far as I'm aware, Commissioner, I'm not aware of any incident where SARS has intrusively spied on a person.
And if there are such incidences, then we must take it seriously. And I certainly am not don't have a partial view as far as this is concerned. I will follow the truth.
A quick one. I'm asking a direct question. From the intrusive equipment, cameras, listening devices, that's what is called intelligent equipment, which is used to spy. Have you not bought such an equipment? That's the question we asked in our letter, and you say the matter of whether you bought or SARS bought an intelligent equipment is with the court, and I'm saying in the court there's no such a matter. In the court is that debate, whether you would have been well within your rights to plant cameras, to listen to people and all those things, meaning engaged in the type of intelligence service that crime intelligence, state security and defense intelligence are often engaged in, the division of which are held accountable elsewhere in secret, because that work must also be monitored so that it does not and violate the constitution, violate the law, violate people's rights. So it's a very direct question. Do you have equipment in SARS that has ever been purchased, which is called intelligence equipment? If you can just give a direct answer to this. Thank you.
I think we have over 4,000. 4,000. One of the things I did, Dr. Ngozi, when I came there, and I had to respond to the specific question by the public protector, I posed the practical question. I said, if the public protector comes here, or if the state security agent comes here and says, we are coming to fetch the rogue unit equipment, what equipment would I give them? I then requested the CFO to do a asset verification of all equipment that we have for gathering information and intelligence. We have a list of over 4,000 such pieces that is kept across the country at various of our offices. So the answer is yes, we have equipment to gather information and intelligence, and it is on record. It is our asset register, which is available if you needed to have further scrutiny of that. There is, in the discussion around the specific equipment, there is equipment that to which the state security agency, the SSA, have been directed, and we are in the discussion with the SSA about the execution of that action that the public protector has given against it. There was a question asked about whether our equipment is kept under surveillance and locked and key. All of our equipment are under surveillance. Surveillance is part of our natural security barriers. We have surveillance cameras in all of our public areas. With regard to the specific equipment that is referred to in some of the papers, yes, of course it is under lock and key, as all of our equipment is under lock and key. So the direct response to your question is yes, we have over 4,000 pieces of equipment. You also asked a question in terms of, there was a second part of your question, just remind me. About the use thereof. Okay? So we have reissued a clarity statement within SARS that wherever we are required to gather information, whether it is through a visual or through a listening device, a recording device, we will disclose that to taxpayers. We are, again, my understanding of the SARS Act, we may do so without permission in public areas. We may not do so without permission within a private, because that would be an invasion of privacy. So I think to the extent that there may be legal interpretations, I'm happy, and I agree with Wayne Broughton, that to the extent that that needs further clarity, we would subject ourselves to that. We have no interest that we're defending other than doing our work.
I just want to know, how will be an intelligent equipment, if I know that there is an intelligent equipment, how intelligent will be that equipment? That's a good question. Do I have to know?
Intelligent.
Okay. So I can put it that way. How will be the intelligent question if I know that there is an intelligent question in the company? Equipment.
I'm certainly not an expert on intelligence equipment. But it can range. Remember, it's information and intelligence gathering that we require to do. And it could be anything from a simple voice recorder to a visual recorder, a video camera, to other devices as you progressively get, and to some of the examples that Dr. Ndlozi refers to, may get increasingly more intrusive and ultimately used for covert purposes. So it's really the broad definition of gathering intelligence would be information that we gather. And certain of our intelligence gathering takes place under the specific provisions in law. So for example, we have a tax inquiry that we can invite someone to. We may go to the court and get an order or a warrant for us to obtain information and to seize certain equipment. So the law is very clear what SARS may or may not do.
Yeah, no, it's just going to respond, I think, overall. Look, Chair, I think, you know, nobody is saying that there are no problems. In fact, a lot of those very equipment may well have been bought between 2014 and 2017. The Commission has been asked to answer for everything before him. I think that is the key point is that in appointing the Commissioner, and certainly with the President since he's come in, the issue has been how to clean up SARS to the extent that, and there are lots of issues that the Nugent report itself uncovers and deals with, which clearly need to be dealt with. And clearly, I mean, the basic principle of the law is that SARS must always operate within the law, as all of us. There's no question about that. And there's absolutely no suggestion that SARS is not operating within the law. To the extent that we are uncovering things, we won't do so. And I say this at Treasury, and I'm sure SARS as well. You know, without fear or favor, we'll do our work. And certainly SARS cannot support or favor or discriminate against any taxpayers. They must do their work. They must collect revenue. That's the first objective. It's not the only objective. And let me say that, you know, I think Dr. George started off saying the report sounds like a horror story. It really is a horror story. Read chapter 3, you'll be shocked. You'll be shocked. Okay. And I think reversing all those bad things that happened has left a mark on SARS. And that means that two things will happen. Its ability to collect revenue, it's going to take SARS at least 2 years before it can be in a decent state, in my estimation, before it can start collecting revenue. It will still have revenue shortfalls because they don't have the expertise, they don't have the people, they don't have whatever, the right culture, they've had to revert, and we should be mindful of that. Secondly, the economy is not growing, okay, which puts further pressure on SARS ability to collect revenue. I think the other point I want to make is on the reputation of SARS and tax morality. Those are extremely, extremely important to deal with. The reputation of SARS, the process to get the reputation right has started. It's not a one or two event, it's a process, and it's winning the confidence of the public, and Dr. George, that's why that will take time. But I think the steps have started. And certainly as Treasury and as SARS, I'm sure we'd both be open to any suggestions for how to improve it, or any problems that we see that need to be dealt with. When you deal with tax morality, Chair, the issue is often, even if SARS were performing very well and is a completely clean organization as we expect it to be, we do need to deal with issues like corruption, with how the money is spent, because that affects taxpayer morality. People will want to pay their taxes if they know government is building roads, there's no potholes, there's no child suffering without food, etc., etc. The things that we make us all committed and to be in government. I think that those issues are quite important to deal with, and that also impacts on tax morality. So I think the challenge is, it's going to be a process, but it's a priority that we put in place to make sure that we get SARS to be functioning efficiently and effectively. And to reiterate, and let me end with this, what the Commissioner has said, if there's any evidence that anybody has of any wrongdoing, please come to the right authority, come to Mr. Kiswetter, tell him, come to the Minister if Mr. Kiswetter is not doing what he's supposed to do. And I have no doubt that these players will act and do the right thing at all times. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Commissioner. Mr. Moment. I think that you should develop a clear program of how you want to implement recommendations of different commissions. Because my understanding, it doesn't mean if you appoint this commission, it nullifies the recommendations of a previous commission. This is not the problem with appointing many commissions. You have the CAD commission. They talked about Minister of Finance appointing a commission. And it goes into detail why they are convinced that should be the case. And you have the DCC, the David. He talked about the board and the role of the board in playing oversight. Then Nugent comes. He comes and talks parallel to DCC. He quotes DCC, but I completely disagree with the recommendation of DCC. And he votes for an IG. Which one are you going to take as a model now? He said yes. Because all these remain commissions appointed by the president. And there's no commissioner which is above the other commission. So you have to come up here whether the Minister of Finance in terms of cuts must appoint the commissioner, but for now, in terms of the current practice, is the president. But CAD has recommended something, and the governance is something that has to be looked at. If you appoint an intelligence general, as Nugent proposes, Nugent also proposes another retired judge. I'm not sure because if a retired judge is creating a job for another retired judge.
and say 100 legal expertise, I don't see any finance or auditing expertise in what you recommend. And SARS is not like a justice related, like public professor, HRC and others. It's more of finance as regulated in the future strategy of the contribution based on finance. What becomes the role of the IG in the main? I have the report. This is the report we are reading here. I'm trying to get what the role of that IG is. Because, for instance, as Parliament, we appoint an intelligence general. We have the clear functions, powers, and duties in regard to playing oversight on the intelligence of the country. I'm not sure, maybe it's my understanding, but in this regard, what Nugent proposes, it's quite difficult for me to comprehend that above the commissioner, you have a retired judge. There's a retired judge already now in the name of the Obus. We met him over 2 weeks ago. He does something else in regard to that. So is this new IG a structure of appeal? What is it? What oversight role is he going to? So it will be probably that Treasurer, which president, come out very, very clear. Because this commission was about integrity and governance. But it contradicts other commissions that were appointed before. Because the previous commissions also dealt with issues of governance. Mm. And they went into details and also looked at the case studies in Europe and other countries. So that's a matter that surely you must come out very clear. It's your responsibility, I believe, as the treasurer, as to which recommendation will be in the best interest of the country. The minister's relationship with the staff, my understanding, that is supposed to be independent. And then the minister appoints executives, and is that how it's supposed to be? What? In terms of the powers of the commissioner, well, why should the minister appoint the executives in what it is? That the minister should appoint the executives, approve the business plan. I'm not sure what the business plan. Will start come here with the ATP, for instance. Can I start account to Parliament? And they come with an APP. Well, what is the business plan? Is it the APP or something else? So there are things that you need to clarify here in regard to the current practice of governance, how as Parliament we relate with institutions like SARC, independent as it is, and how the minister is supposed to come in. And the panel, Judge Nugent says the panel should be composed of apolitical in South Africa. I don't know. Because the Constitution gives everybody a political right. So if Judge Nugent says the panel should be apolitical, how do you qualify that, Mr. Mumia? And not answerable to any constituent. I don't know. And the previous panel that we have, there were two or so politicians. Honorable Bukabere, Mr. Len was a member of that panel, isn't it?
Who is that?
Honorable Jeff Kalev. Was he not? But there was a former minister of finance.
Mr. Manuel was a minister. He wasn't holding any political office at the time.
So as political class means you must be holding a political office or completely you should not be involved in any political activity.
I think that was what the Nugent Commission was saying, that they mustn't be a current member of an active member of a political party, like MP, holding being an MP or holding an office.
Okay, clear all this, yes. So that we understand that Parliament, we should not second guess,
yes,
what our political means, because it must mean something like the author of the report. So those are some of the issues that I thought I should raise. Like, there must be a deputy commissioner, but the deputy commissioner should not have power, and no executive should account to the deputy commissioner. It's what is in the report.
Yes.
So it's a ceremonial position. If that's the case, so you have a chicken there at in Brooklyn. I don't know. I'm not sure if you have written what is here. I mean, it's the same things which are very difficult to compare. That there must be a deputy commissioner to the current commissioner, but who has got no executive power, and executives should not report to him. But in the case that the commissioner needs, he can be somebody who can be good for, to be appointed. It's like when there were COOs in some companies, it's like somebody who's eyeing to be a CEO. So I've read this report and tried to interpret my own way. And I'm saying that Treasury should come out very clear, probably in another meeting, to say, out of all the commissions that we have had before, including this one, which recommendations are they taking forward? Probably they must discuss with the president, because the president will appoint commissioners, and come out clearly if you recommend the change of, amendment of legislation, policy, so that there's no ambiguity in the implementation of all these commissions that have been there before. Thank you very much, honorable members, commissioner, DG, and Lydia. Let's adjourn for lunch, and we'll meet at 2 in the house.